Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Forgotten Horror Classics. My name is Paulie Presenza, known as the Moo Cow, and as some of you folks might know me as one of the co-hosts for Indie Film Cafe. And tonight I have with me...
Lenore. Hi.
Hi, Lenore. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Excellent. All right, so tonight we are going to watch a movie called Spider Baby. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Okay. It's a pretty interesting film. One of the reasons I wanted to choose it, in addition to being sort of a cult movie, fanatics cult movie, is the fact that, A, it's also very, very good, but B, it also stars Sid Haig, who is one of my favorite character actors from the horror genre, who I think I remember telling you earlier died not too long ago, pretty recently. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to use this movie as a tribute to him. He's one of the stars in this. And as a matter of fact, this particular director sort of discovered Sid Haig, and he's Jack Hill, and he was in a number of Jack Hill's movies. So I just wanted to take this opportunity to sort of kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. In any event, we'll take a little break and hear some weird music, and then we'll come back and we will discuss Spider Baby. Okay, looks like we are back. All right, so Miss Lenore, what did you think of Spider Baby?
I don't know. It was strange.
It's a bit of a strange movie, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's got elements of comedy. It's got elements of horror without really kind of being, you know, 100% of either one.
That's true.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the background of the film. So, Spider Baby was made by director Jack Hill. Jack Hill is a director. He's considered a sort of exploitation director. Does a lot of exploitation kinds of films.
Exploitation?
Yeah, it's pretty much a term for sort of what you might consider sort of cheap B movies that sort of take advantage of things, usually nudity or violence or stuffing like that. Where that's really kind of the thing to sort of drag the kids in so that you can make money from it. And in fact, his era was really the 70s. He did a lot of what was called blaxploitation films. So he did one called Kofi and Foxy Brown. He did Switchblade Sisters. He did a bunch of stuff that actually a lot of people now attribute. And people like, you know, Quentin Tarantino considers him quite an influence. In fact, I think it was Quentin Tarantino who called him the Howard Hawks of exploitation filmmaking. So he made this film, and I think this is his first full-length feature that he shot himself as the primary director, as the only director. And because he did one earlier, it was called Mondo Keyhole, but it was kind of like a survey movie of different things. It wasn't really an action or it didn't really have actors. So this is really his first movie for that. And he actually shot this in 1964, and it's black and white, and actually shot really, really nicely in black and white. But the problem is he had this movie financed by a couple of guys who were in the real estate business. They're the ones who put up the money. It was like $65,000. Unfortunately, by the time the movie was about to come out, they kind of went bankrupt. So the movie, even though it was finished, sat in limbo for 4 years. So it didn't actually get released until 1968. And sort of by then, you know, black and white films were kind of out. And the whole tone of it and everything, it's definitely shot for 1964, 1965. By 1968, with the new hippie revolution and the way that movies were being done then, it was definitely too late, which is unfortunate because when it came out, it just kind of got ignored. But over the years, people talked about it and talked about it, and I think somebody ended up restoring it and re-releasing it much later on, I think in the 80s and 90s, and then it became a big deal again. So it's kind of been rediscovered, which is really cool. And it's probably my favorite Jack Hill movie. So that's really interesting. There's a lot of stories about what happened there. I think he mentions that he actually never made a dime back from it, unfortunately. But it's also considered quite an example of daring filmmaking and very influential for a movie like that. And it was only shot in 12 days, which is pretty interesting, too. One of the other problems is that by the time it finally did come out, people really weren't sure how to talk about it. Because, like I said, it's kind of an odd film. So it's not a straightforward horror movie. It's not a straightforward comedy. It's not a straightforward anything. And it ended up having a lot of different titles. And that kind of confused people, too. So, you know, on the one hand, it's Spider Baby, but it's also The Maddest Story Ever Told. It also was The Liver Eaters, then it became Attack of the Liver Eaters. Cannibal Orgy, I believe, was the very first title that it had, even though you don't really see anything like that. That's kind of what the Merry family degenerates into. So, yeah, that was kind of the problem, too. I've always been partial to Spider Baby. The cast is pretty darn exceptional, too. So, Bruno is played by Lon Chaney Jr. You probably have at least heard of him, I'm sure. He plays the chauffeur and caretaker. He also actually sings that really interesting kind of strange song in the beginning.
Oh, the, okay, yeah.
That was pretty...
One of the credits.
Right, that was pretty cool. He'd been making movies since the 30s. He was, The Scream of the Night in 1935. He, of course, was famously in Of Mice and Men in 1939. And then his most famous role would have been The Wolfman in 1941. Mummy's Tomb in 1942, Son of Dracula in 1943, he was in High Noon in the 50s, Dr. Terror's House of Horror by the time you get into the 60s, Dracula vs. Frankenstein was his final movie in 1971, unfortunately, with the regrettable Al Adamson. But he'd been in a lot of films, and so he brought a very serious horror cachet with him, even though by the time the 60s and 70s were around, he was sort of going the way of a lot of the older actors were, and they were just kind of grabbing whatever roles they could. But he's kind of like the rock of the film. And then the two young girls, the spider babies, as you would. The first one is Jill Banner. She played Virginia. She's the one who loves the spiders and wants to sting, sting, sting. And she's the brunette with the longer hair. She was in a movie called Deadlier Than the Male, ironically, in 1966, in which she plays a secret agent assassin. She was also in a movie called The Stranger Returns in 1967. And then she was in a bunch of TV shows, including Dragnet and Adam 12, etc. But things kind of dried up for her, and she ended up leaving the business and became a real estate agent in 1976. And then, strangely enough, she kind of got into a relationship with, of all people, Marlon Brando. I'm not exactly sure how that happened, but they were involved for a while. And then, just at a point where I believe she was starting to think about coming back into the pictures, she was tragically struck and killed by a truck in 1982. So she, 35 years old, she died. Quite unfortunate. The other sister, Elizabeth, is played by Beverly Washburn, who is another person who is in a whole bunch of TV shows. She was in, Adventures of Superman in 1951. She was in Leave It to Beaver in 1959. Dragnet, The Lone Ranger, Gidget, Wagon Train, Star Trek, the original.
Really?
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And she was in a few other movies. She was in Jack Hill's other film he did called Pit Stop in 1969. And then she started coming back and was in some of a few later films. There was Astro Zombies M4 Invaders from Cyberspace in 2012, Paranormal Extremes Text Message from the Dead in 2015, and Tales of Frankenstein in 2018. So she's kind of coming back, which is nice to see.
Wait, did she play Nurse?
Nope, she was Elizabeth. She was the blonde sister.
No, I mean in Star Trek, did she play the nurse?
No, I don't remember exactly what character she played. I'll have to look that up.
Oh.
I just know that she was in an episode of the original. And then, of course, there's Sid Haig, and he's really kind of the guy that I really wanted to do this show for and to sort of dedicate this show to. Sid Haig's been in a million things. You might not know him very well, but most horror fans know him. Devil's Rejects, and he was in a really excellent film called Bone Tomahawk back in 2015. Big Dollhouse, he was also in Kofi, he's just in a bunch of stuff. one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet. You know, he was always, every year he would always come to Scares the Care in Williamsburg. He's just one of the nicest people. And I know he loved Spider Baby. I think part of it is because it really didn't, at the time, have a whole lot of people who saw it. And people saw it later, they really liked it, and he liked talking about it because he had a really good time. And it's one of his earlier films. And I don't have a whole lot of celebrity autographs because I just don't think they have very much value to me. But the one that I do have is Sid Haig, who autographed my Spider Baby poster for me. So that's pretty cool.
You have a Spider Baby poster?
I have a Spider Baby poster. It's in the studio.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it's signed by Sid Haig.
I'll have to look for it.
So he, of course, is playing Ralph, the unforgettable Ralph in the film, the brother. And he does it without saying any lines. I guess you noticed that. What did you think of Ralph?
The description seemed pretty accurate. He was like a big kid.
Exactly. He seems somewhat less dangerous than the sisters, although, of course, it turns out kind of was.
I think he was only like that though, the sister's direction.
Right. Right.
Left his own devices, I think he would have been pretty harmless.
Unless you're a cat.
Unless you're a cat.
Okay, so getting back to the cast, Quinn Redeker played Peter. He's the older Uncle Peter, the nice guy who comes. And he was in a bunch of stuff, too. He actually started off in a Three Stooges movie. He was in Three Stooges Meet Hercules, which is kind of interesting. And then he ends up getting into other films, a very strange selection of films. He was in At Long Last Love, which was kind of a bomb, Electric Horseman. Then he was in Ordinary People, which actually won Academy Awards. And he was in a whole bunch of TV stuff. He was in Sea Hunt, Lock Up, Bonanza, That Girl, Ironside, $6 Million Man, Adam 12, Bob Newhart, Rockford Files, a whole bunch of stuff. So he became pretty much a regular there. And he was also a writer. And he is one of the people who helped write a movie called The Deer Hunter, which is an absolutely fabulous, fabulous film. So he's definitely kind of been in the business for a while. And let's see, his sister, the sort of meaner one, is Carol Omart. She plays Emily. Her big thing is when she first came out, she was kind of like considered the next Marilyn Monroe. And that's kind of like one of those curses a lot of blonde actresses got back then, because of course you never get to follow that up and become the next Marilyn Monroe.
Was it because she was blonde that she was called? Yes,
she was blonde and somewhat statuesque. So she was in stuff like The Scarlet Hour and The Wild Party, and then her big thing was she was in House on Haunted Hill, which was sort of the big movie with Vincent Price. She was also in Wild Youth and The Spectre of Edgar Allan Poe. She was also in a bunch of TV stuff, and unfortunately she passed away in 2002. So that's the main group of actors that are in the film. So I guess we could talk a little bit about the plot. The movie opens up with Quinn Redeker character's Peter talking about how there's this curse, quote-unquote, of a family malady. I guess it's like a genetic malady that runs through the family, runs through the Mary family, of which he is part of. And it's a degenerative disorder where people sort of regress into some sort of state of violence and decrepitude and eventual savagery, even hinting at cannibalism. And he goes on to sort of explain his experiences of what happens. And he ends up going there with his sister because they are trying to dispose of the property. They show up with a lawyer and the lawyer's secretary. And they end up meeting Bruno and the girls and Ralphie. And just kind of all heck breaks loose because they are not accustomed to meeting people. They are just kind of crazy and murderous and just plain nuts. Very first thing you see is the poor postman who shows up on his motorcycle looking for the Mary house, and he's like asking directions, and people are like, oh no, we don't want anything to do with it. And then he shows up and falls prey to Virginia's spiderweb. And it's funny because you think it's kind of funny at first because he's kind of got the big wide eyes. He's like, oh please, someone tell me that they're here. And he gets into the little trap, and you know, you kind of think at first that it's sort of a joke, and then all of a sudden the spider stings and it's no joke. I think she's like slicing him, and just, you can just imagine what's going on. I think an ear comes off at one point. What did you think of that scene?
Part of it was funny, and then it got not funny.
Right. The tone is very strange. This happens a lot in the film. You know, I mean, there are scenes that are funny, but there are scenes that are just super creepy as well.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
So, at this point, Bruno comes back and discovers what's going on, and he chides them. And the sisters are sort of like, they seem very childlike.
That's true, yeah. That's probably one of the creepier aspects, is how they talk and move, in spite of their age.
Right.
Also, I don't know how old they were.
It's hard to say. I would have said teens, you know, 16, 17 maybe. They're short, so it's difficult to tell. But yeah, they're sort of innocent in a way. They, you know, to them, this is like...
A game,
or even, dare I say, normal, you know? They don't see, you know, murder for what it is. So that's kind of why Bruno is there sort of protecting them, quote-unquote, to begin with. So they have as little contact with the outside world as possible. I think he mentions that at one point two kids climbed over their fence, and he doesn't say what happened to them other than I guess they get into Virginia's web, and after that people started to ask about them, which clearly is not something they want to have happen. But it's interesting because obviously Ralph ends up going to the doctor at least quite a lot, because, you know, while Bruno is telling all this, Ralph's in the car, and he opens up the door and says, "We're home now, Ralph," and he just kind of crawls out. And he's bald, and he's, you know, his clothes are too small for him, and he looks skinny and gangly and strange, and he's got a giant mouth that it just seems like he's very grotesque.
Yeah, I wonder what he was being taken to the doctor for.
It could be just about anything, I don't know. But I guess he's the elder of the two, because... Bruno suggests that it's not going to be long before he goes with Uncle Ted and his two aunts, whom you don't see until the end. And clearly, they have regenerated to the point where they are kind of savage, and they have seemed like they almost had fangs and hairy faces. And
yeah.
And at least one of them was mewling like a cat.
And I noticed that, like, the girls had very long, sharp fingernails.
Oh, yeah.
That seemed pretty odd, especially considering that they didn't seem like they otherwise cared about maintaining nails or anything like that.
It's interesting. So talk a little bit about the two sisters and how you saw them. They kind of manifest very different personalities, don't you think?
Yeah. All I can think of is that one book I read in high school, The Fall of the House of Usher.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the siblings in that book.
Right, on steroids.
Yeah.
Or crack.
Actually, that makes sense, because in the Fall of the House of Usher, literally falls, and in this movie, it blows up.
There you go.
Oh, maybe I should have put in a spoiler warning.
That's okay. But yeah, so Elizabeth is the brunette with the long hair, who's the spider, who is the spider baby. That's Virginia. Sorry, yeah, you're right, that's Virginia. She seems just very physical, you know. I mean, she likes stalking her little fly victims, and she's got her two knives. She kind of teases them. She clacks them together and then goes, sting, 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 you know.
I guess Elizabeth is the younger one.
See, I think Elizabeth is the older one. I think she's, because remember, she's always looking after them. You know, she's always the one put in charge. So I think she might be the one who's a little older.
But if they regress with age, wouldn't it make sense that the youngest has the most maturity?
You would think.
Maybe she's the youngest.
Maybe she's the youngest.
The most faculties left.
It's possible. Of course, her faculties are still kind of strange, because she's kind of like the, you know, the teasing sister. She's like, she's going to hate you. You're going to be in trouble. You know what I mean?
She does fixate on the word hate.
She does. Yeah, usually. And she's also the one who seems to be coming up with plans. You know, she's a little bit more calculating than Virginia. Virginia just seems to be more reactionary.
Yeah.
You know. And then Ralphie, who, it's funny because Peter describes him as kind of a big kid. Emily doesn't like him, like, from the beginning. As soon as she sees him, she's already decided that he's just creepy and awful and terrible. You know, you kind of feel bad for Ralphie, at least at first.
Yeah. He, for the most part, he does act like a big kid. And he is wearing, like, too small clothing, which kind of helps that impression.
Right. But then, of course, later on, as the movie progresses, you do see he does have a dangerous side. He jumps on the cat. That's the first idea that things are not very good. And he helps eat it as well. And then, of course, he ends up fixating on and getting a hold of Emily. And then Anne later on, the secretary. Now, exactly what happens, I'm a little... It's not quite clear. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because at some point, Emily is in the room trying on lingerie that she discovered in a wardrobe.
Yeah, that was... That's already kind of weird anyway.
You think?
Yeah, why would you do that?
Trying on other people's clothing?
Yeah.
I'm not even sure exactly whose that would be. Maybe it's Bruno's. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not the dad's room.
No. Oh, yeah. We haven't gotten to dad's room yet. But, so she's in there, and of course, Ralphie is still obsessing over her, so he crawls down, upside down from the floor above, like a vampire, and he ends up spying on her through the window, and she eventually sees him and wigs out and goes running out the door in her lingerie, and of course, the girls see her and they say she's going to tell because they've already killed Schlocker, the lawyer for snooping.
Yeah, I can't say I blame her for getting freaked out and running.
Right.
But I still can't help but wonder, why are you trying on clothing you just found?
In a creepy house?
Yeah.
I don't know, other than the fact that, of course, when you're, you know, in your underwear, if you're naked, you're in those kind of clothing, you're considered, you know, people feel very vulnerable. So I guess maybe she's feeling vulnerable, but she freaks out and runs, and of course they go looking for her to silence her because she's going to tell, quote unquote. She gets away from the girls only to be jumped by Ralph. You know, they just kind of collapse onto the ground and you don't really follow them to see exactly what happens. So, I don't know. Charitably, you might say, you know, maybe he just smothered her, but she survived. Raped? I don't know. I mean...
She still had all her clothes on when she woke up.
She did. So I try not to think raped. I hope not.
Yeah.
But it's hard to say. She ends up coming back, and strangely, she seemed to be sort of fixated on Ralph after that. Did you notice?
Yeah, I thought maybe like he'd bitten her or something, and now she was a Mary with the curse and everything. But that doesn't seem like it fits.
No. No, it's just she decided, I don't know, it's like she's, you know, it reminded me of a scene in Young Frankenstein where, you know, the one woman is terrified of the Frankenstein until they actually have sex, and all of a sudden,
she's
like, oh, I like you after all, you know, that kind of a thing, and maybe that's kind of what's going on there.
Maybe.
It's a little weird, but she shows up towards the end and sees that Ralphie has the other girl, the other blonde, the quote-unquote pretty lady, who's Anne, the secretary, and he's got her now, and they're trying to debate on what to do, and then she sees him, and she immediately attacks Ralphie, not because of what happened in the garden, but because he's got the girl, you know what I mean? And so he, like, she, like, goes for his eyes and everything, and you get the feeling she either scratched his eyes or injured him pretty badly, because... You know, he bends over, and that's really all you see. And then, before anything else can happen, that's when the rest of the Mary family sort of grab her and drag her down into the pit and start doing whatever it is that they're doing down there, presumably doing their little cannibal thing.
Yeah. And then Uncle Peter, I think?
Mm-hmm.
The one who was nice to the kids, he manages to escape from the chair he was tied down to.
Right. What happened there? How did he get in the chair?
Virginia wanted to play spider and he didn't know what that meant. So he volunteered and she wrapped him up in like a rope web to the chair. And she was gonna cut him up, but got distracted by something and left. And he was able to break the chair afterwards and walked away. Oh, the spiders.
That's right.
The tarantulas.
There's that too. But let's not forget, this is kind of a multi-layered scene. There's other stuff going on there too. Because the only reason that they're there in the first place is because they couldn't find rooms in the village, so they had to drive back, which the girls weren't expecting. They show up, and they were able to come up with some kind of a plan, and Elizabeth takes Anne away upstairs to Dad's room, which is not a place you want to go. And then Virginia entertains Uncle Peter. With the spider game, but she's also like, you know, she sort of says that she likes Uncle Peter, that he's not like the others. And
that was weird.
She gets a little coquettish, you know. She's
coquettish?
Yeah, what's you know, coquettish? Sort of like a young tease.
Oh, okay.
You know, she starts touching him and she climbs into his lap and she raises her dress up to show off her legs and thighs.
Yeah, Uncle Peter seemed quite freaked out.
Because she's like, do you like me? Do you like? Well, first he says, do you like pretty lady? And he's like, yeah. And then she says, do you like me? And he's a little freaked out.
Yeah, he never actually responds, which is probably a good move there.
Right. And it's funny because, you know, up until this point, Uncle Peter has been pretty affable. He seems like a really, really nice guy. You know, I mean, he's nice to pretty much everyone, even his crabby sister. And he's very, very flummoxed at that point.
Can't blame him. I mean, he thought he was just going to, like, find a room and go to sleep.
Right.
He didn't think he was going to have to deal with tarantulas and weird nieces and knives and everything.
And you have to wonder at that time, had he been open to Virginia's very strange advances, what might have happened, but... He rebuffs her, and she seems very disappointed and says something along the lines of, I guess bugs don't like spiders. And then he's like, I like spiders. And then she's like, I'm going to have to sting you now. Yeah, it's really kind of a weird scene.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, I like this film because, like I said, there's a lot of stuff kind of going on at the same time. So, meanwhile, while all this is going on, Bruno is hit upon the idea that since he's already seen the girls killing Schlocker, and he has no idea what's happened with Emily, but I'm sure he can imagine the worst, he's figuring out, you know, we can't have this continue on. Because he knows that even if they were to get away with these two murders, there's just going to be more people coming, and they can't kill them all. So he figures the only thing he can do is to just put an end to it. And the quickest way is to go get some dynamite. Now, there's a scene early on when he has taken the Rolls Royce out to pick up Schlocker and the secretary to bring them to the house. And they stop in the road, and the Schlocker's like, "What? Why are we stopping here? What's going on?" And Bruno has to explain, well, they're dynamiting up ahead because they're putting in the new road.
Oh, I forgot about that scene.
Right. Remember, then it starts exploding, and he ends up, you know, while they're waiting, grilling him and trying to get information. So that sets the scene for later on where Bruno knows that there's dynamite at the site. He doesn't even bother putting on clothing. He just kind of runs out there in his pajamas, and he gets a crowbar, and he manages to pry open the shed that has all the dynamite, and he brings it all back and goes down into the basement where everybody is sort of going crazy, and he lights one of the dynamite things, fuses on fire, and that's when Uncle Peter comes down the stairs with the chair and breaks out, and he says, yeah, Peter, you should probably get out of here really quickly.
Yeah, he, was that the secretary again, or his
right,
sister?
Right. So, at this point, Emily has injured Ralph, so he's kind of down and out. She's falling into the pit and is also down and out and getting et, I presume. Anne was on the table. Remember, they were trying to, like, saw her foot off or something.
Oh, yeah.
It was so weird. It's like she's trying to bleed them. She's trying to bleed her so that she wouldn't scream, which is, I guess, is her way of being nice because she actually liked her. This is Virginia. So she just collapses and rolls off the table, and it's funny, she ends up falling right into a coffin.
Yeah. They just had one there for
right.
some reason.
So Bruno's like, I think it's time that you leave. And he's like, okay, because he sees the dynamite, and he goes over and picks up poor Anne and gets her out of there. And they run outside into the yard to get away, and that's when the house blows up, and presumably that's the end. And then at the very end, you go back to Peter explaining everything that's going on, and he closes the book and says, you know, that's it. That's the end of the disease. It's the end of the curse. Because that part of the family is deceased. There's nobody else left, and his branch of the family supposedly didn't get it, and he's perfectly fine. And the movie ends where he mentions that he and Anne have gotten married, and they have a kid, and they're living a nice, happy life in the suburbs someplace. And then you see the daughter come in, what was it, Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
And Jessica's like, oh, can I go out and play? And Anne's like, oh, sure. You know, just come in before it rains, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the kid goes out into the backyard and is looking around, and then she sees a spider and gets all excited. So you're like, you know, uh-oh, has the Mary curse continued? And then it goes, the end, and then there's a question mark, you know. I think you asked about the recessive genes or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure how Jessica Mary, I guess, inherits the disorder if the children... Like, Virginia, Elizabeth, and Ralphie had it because they were inbred.
Right.
And presumably Anne and Peter aren't related, and they're only a distant branch of the Mary family. So how did Jessica get it?
I wonder if it really matters. I mean, I'm not a geneticist, so I don't know, but does it matter how close they are? I mean, how distant they are?
It can, because the more generations, the more distance, the less and less likely it is to be passed on.
Because... one of the things he mentions, and I think Bruno also talks about, is that the malady has been running in the family for quite some time, for many, many years, a number of generations. Of course, you wonder how, if that's the case, how did they manage to procreate enough to keep generations going? But I guess they did.
Maybe it was just like one or two each generation.
That's possible, too. So, and at least... Daddy managed to at least procreate enough to have a family, and he doesn't seem to have been affected by it, because we find out what happens to Daddy. He
looks like he's just died of old age.
Possibly, but he's his unburied corpse, somewhat mummified, is there in his room in his bed, and they it's funny because the girls are all tuck him in, quote unquote, and kiss him goodnight, and they're just, it's a corpse.
Yeah.
Again, sort of black humor, but also creepy as fuck. I mean, that's just gross. That's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of stuff.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a lot of stuff in Texas Chainsaw Massacre that I think is touched by this film. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Although, at the end, there is still the question of, we don't know if Jessica has it or not.
That's true. That's true.
She looks 12? And I thought spiders were cool when I was 12.
Well, I think in the beginning he said it was 10 years ago, so I think she was 10. That, I think, at least that's my impression.
Oh.
And remember, 10 is right around the age that he says is when it starts. So maybe this is the first moment of its manifesting.
Maybe.
And really, it's genetically, it's just a crapshoot, isn't it? I mean, it's just a chance. You know, so I suppose it's possible, even if it's a distant relation, that... you know, the genetic malformity just carried through, and it was just luck of the draw that she happens to get it, in which case, bad for the family, because that means it's still going on. I mean, you can't really ever really get rid of a genetic defect, can you? I mean, I don't know.
It gets less likely each generation, but I guess there's always a chance someone's a carrier.
Exactly.
But it still brings up the question of, how does Jessica have it if Anne's not related to the family?
I'm not sure. I guess it passed on somehow through Peter.
Oh, maybe. The only other question I have is, how did everybody know to pronounce the last name as Mary? Because it's like M-E-R-R-Y-E. It looks like it's Mirai.
Or Mary-ye is what I was thinking.
Or Mary or Mirai or...
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad they said Mary before I saw the word Mary, because, you know, as soon as they said it and we saw it, it made sense.
Like, the postman knew it was pronounced Mary, the townspeople knew it was pronounced Mary. How did everybody know it was Mary?
Good question. Well, it's certainly more convenient. And, you know, the film is not without its flaws. You know, it probably could have used a few more dollars. Although I thought the house was pretty convincing, didn't you?
Yeah.
The house was pretty damn creepy. And I liked the way that it was shot. You noticed when you first see the film, it's all low angles. So you're seeing everything mm-hmm. up there. So it's like the big spooky house on the hill that, you know, back in the day, every town seemed to have that one haunted house up on the hill someplace.
It was a pretty house, though.
Sure, if it wasn't covered with cobwebs and rats and spiders and dead things.
The outside was pretty.
And it always looked like the walls had something splattered on it.
Oh, well, the outside of the house was...
Oh, sure. The outside was nice.
Which leads me to wonder, was it shot at the same house as the outside grounds, or...
I'm not really sure. I very much doubt that they could have built a set for only $65,000 back then. So I presume they shot it on location in someone's property. I can't imagine who. At least the exterior shots, as far as the interior shots go, that could have been anywhere. I'd have to do a little more research on the film to see where that particular buildings were, at least where the interiors were. But just a lot of odd twists and turns. There's that dumbwaiter that goes down to the basement. You know, that Ralphie seems to love to ride going up and down. And there's that one creepy scene. It's funny when Peter's playing the sting game or the spider game and he's wrapped up and she's about to sting him. And then she stops and then you hear the dumbwaiter going and down comes Ralphie with Anne and he's got his hand over her mouth so she can't scream. And meanwhile, Peter's like, oh, so what are you doing? What's going on? She's like, shh. And he doesn't notice that his friend is being, you know, put in harm's way, going right past him, and he just never sees it.
At the time, he also didn't seem to realize he was in harm's way either.
Right. Yay. Nice as Peter is, he does sort of underestimate the kids.
I mean, considering his introduction to them through Bruno, kind of makes sense.
Right. I mean, Emily, even though she's kind of crabby and money-grubbing, she pretty much finds the kids creepy right off the bat. I mean, she kind of picks up on it pretty quickly, you know?
Yeah.
So, what about Schlocker? What did you think of him?
I don't think he should have died. I mean, he was doing his job and he made some good points. The kids probably should have been in a hospital.
Right. He probably got a little too nosy for his own good.
That's true, but when you're surrounded by that much creepiness and nothing seems to be adding up, I might have done the same thing.
Well, he ends up doing a little too much snooping, and the girls find him. And it's funny because they switch like that. I mean, they seem kind of sweet and innocent and everything, and then all of a sudden, when they're on the stairs... And the way that the movie has, the way that it's shot, so they're, part of them is lit, but their faces are in shadow. It just, and they're standing up above, they just look very ominous, you know?
Yeah.
And you can't really sure what's going on, and then he shines the light on them, and then their eyes are huge, they've got weapons, and he's like, oh, shit. You know, and that's, of course, bad news for him. You know, Virginia comes after him with her stingers, and then, Elizabeth has a, what is that? I think it was a pitchfork, and it's like stabbing him with it.
I guess it was a pitchfork.
Yeah.
Bent than that.
So, yeah, not a happy way to go. There are not a whole lot of happy endings in this particular film, for the victims at least. And, you know, it's kind of a shame for the poor post guy. I mean, I kind of felt bad for him.
Yeah, he was also just doing his job.
Right. Well, and that's the thing about crazy people is that they're not doing this out of spite or out of revenge or out of, you know, personal animosity. They're just nuts. You know what I mean? Just crazy. I mean, this. You look at it from a spider's point of view. In Virginia's case, it's not gonna kill the bug because it hates the bug. It's just because it is a bug, and that's what spiders do.
Yeah. Which really leads me to wonder, why didn't the postman just leave the letter, like, in a mailbox, or...
Well, I never saw a mailbox. Or something. I never saw a mailbox, but yeah, you're right. I mean, I probably would not have done what he did, which is to sort of stick my head inside of a house.
Inside the window of the unknown creepy house that everyone's
scared. Exactly. I mean, I might have gone up and rang the bell and knocked on the door like he did, but I probably would have ended up sliding it under the door or something like that.
Or duct taping it to the door or to a
gate
or...
But of course, you know, if he doesn't die, then the movie, you know, doesn't have its wonderful way of introducing you to Virginia, the spider baby herself. And it doesn't set the tone. And it's a very mixed tone, you know. Yeah.
Comedy. It starts off really funny.
Right.
When she just walks in with the rope web and says, I have a spider web. Or
a little bug in my web.
Yeah. And then it gets less funny.
Pretty quickly. Yeah. And she's like, now I have to sting. And it's just, she does it with such glee. Such evil glee.
Which is weird, because spiders don't sting, they bite.
True. Well, I don't know. Maybe there are some that do. I don't know. I can't think of any that... Well, I guess some of them do have venom, but it's not on a stinger. It's in their mandibles, I think. But we watched a little bit of the commentary. Jack Hill was talking about how he had come up with this idea of these two evil little girls. And that's really the basis for what was originally Cannibal Orgy, but ended up becoming Spider Baby. Because, you know, I think he mentions that while there is some cannibalism, and while it's certainly inferred, it's all off camera. You're not really seeing that. It's sort of assumed. You know, at one point, I know when she's stinging the poor postman, she cuts off the ear of the guy, and then she just saves it and puts it in a box, and Schlocker ends up finding that later on.
And he just closes the box and puts it back.
Yeah, he's like, okay, let's pretend we never saw that. And puts it away. But yeah, so I think initially it might have been something more along the lines of a traditional kind of, I don't want to say a slasher movie, but, you know, a cannibal or a monster movie. And then it ended up becoming more about these two evil little girls. And that's really what it is, you know? Sort of, it's almost, I almost wish that they had made them twins. That would have been interesting.
Yeah. It reminded me a little of The Shining with the girls at the end of the hallway.
Exactly.
Although they weren't twins either.
No, I think they just were dressed alike.
Yeah. They were like 2 years apart, but for some reason they were the same height.
Right, and they looked pretty close. But even the sisters themselves in that particular film, I believe, are not twins. They just look very similar, and they were dressed very similar. But that just makes it even creepier, you know?
Yeah.
Because if they're twins, you might expect that. But if they're not twins and they look alike, there's just something off and strange about that. In this case, the girls were not twins. They were very physically different.
Blonde and brunette,
hair length. Their faces were different. Disturbingly, both of them are walking around in fairly thin, I don't want to say night clothing, but that's what it looked like. It looked like they were in I don't want to say lingerie either, but nightgowns. That's what it looked like, don't you think?
Yeah.
Hard to say.
Looks like identical monogrammed nightgowns, actually.
Right, right. And creepily, I think they looked a little bit more fetching than any of that. Hey, they really had the right to look. I think that's another part of the creepy thing.
Oh, I didn't notice that. I guess it's because they're kind of childlike.
Right, well, or at least somewhat, they act somewhat childlike. Physically, they're probably more adults, like I said, teenagers. But that's another level of creepiness that's going on, too. You know, there's always that whole thing of playing against type when you're evil. You know, it's easy to be evil when you're awful and ugly and horrible. Like, you know, there you go, Bruno. Lon Chaney Jr. would have been perfect. He spent his career as this big, huge, jowly giant of a man who was always playing monsters, and yet in this film, he is the sort of real nice, gentle guy who wouldn't hurt a fly, you know? And then you have these two girls who are super pretty, and they're just evil and horrible as heck, and they'll kill you just for the heck of it, just because they think it's a fun game of Sting. So, yeah, kind of an interesting little parallel there, if you ask me. So, as far as some of the other films that you've seen, this is a little different, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was forgotten for a long time, and I'm glad that it's out. And we actually had the director's cut, which is really cool. I'm hoping it's out in Blu-ray at some point. It probably is. I just haven't gotten around to getting it yet. You know, at least this version had commentary. It had some making of. It had a lot of fun little extra stuff that's in there. I'm really glad that I had a chance to sort of show this not only to you, but to sort of get this out there in Forgotten Horror Classics so that other people can dig it up. Now, I believe that there are public domain prints running around, and I think that it's, if you look onto YouTube, you can probably see it there. But for more serious cinephiles, I do recommend that you get the director's cut DVD or possible Blu-ray if that's out there, because they cleaned it up. It looks a whole lot better than the public domain versions. And that's another thing, is that I thought that it was shot really, really well. The interior shots and the exterior shots were all really, really nice. There were only a couple of scenes where I think the cinematographer lost focus. Remember when Peter was in his chair and he's struggling to get out?
Yeah, and it briefly went a little blurry.
I guess they weren't able to fix that, at least in the DVD. Now, who knows? Maybe in the Blu-ray version, they're able to clean that up. Who knows? There may be all kinds of extras out there. Like I said, unfortunately, Jill Banner's no longer with us. Lon Chaney Jr.'s no longer with us. Sid Haig, unfortunately, is no longer with us. There's a number of folks who are no longer around, but Jack Hill is still here. And a number of the other folks who were in there, Quinn Rediker and other folks. So they could do a new commentary version about this if they really wanted to. I don't know who owns the rights to this, but I would love to see a Blu-ray version. I think it'd be very cool, especially if they do new commentary, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that about wraps it up. As I said, this is one that I wanted to make sure that I got out there as a tribute to Sid Haig, one of the nicest guys in show business. And fortunately, he passed away, and we will no longer have him. But I do know that he really enjoyed this film and his work in this film. And he enjoyed working with Jack Hill, who really kind of founded him. Jack Hill founded a number of people in the business, and Sid Haig was one of them. I know Alan Bernstein was somebody that he discovered. And let's see, I think there were one or two other people. Pam Grier, definitely, for the work that she did in Kofi and Foxy Brown and a few others. So he's around still. I'd love to hear if he had more tales. I wish that Sid Haig was around. I wish that, you know, I could have talked to him a bit more about Spider Baby when I had the chance. I got to talk a little bit, but, you know, when you're at these conventions, you're in a line with a whole bunch of people and you just have a couple minutes and, you know, you say hello and you get them to sign something and you say thank you, and that's about it. He was coming to every single Scares That Care, so, you know, if he hadn't died, I would have loved to have had a chance, because, you know, we're doing Indie Film Cafe Spotlights, where we're starting to do interviews with people in the business, and he would have made a great interview. And like I said, I would have loved to have talked to him more about Spider Baby, but unfortunately, that's not going to happen. But there is a lot of interesting information out there. I suggest anybody who is curious about the film, in addition to buying the DVD, the director's cut of it, that you go out and read as much as you can about it, because it's a pretty fascinating film. Did you think it was... I know you didn't think Hotel or Horror Hotel was particularly scary, although it was creepy. What about this film?
It's not as creepy as it could be, I think.
Mm.
I don't know if that's just because of the film style of the time, or if it just wasn't meant to be very creepy, but it's silly in a way, too. So I think I'll be able to sleep easy enough.
Well, that's good. Unlike Horror Hotel, it's not sort of playing against type, though. It's, you know, at the same time, it's also trying to be comedic, whereas Horror Hotel had nothing like that. There was no humor in that I remember. It was more of a straight up traditional horror film.
Oh. I thought the scene with the cross was funny.
Well, yeah, you might have, but it wasn't supposed to be. the humor in this, there's supposed to be, although just a very odd sense of humor. Definitely out there. A lot of the cast who talk about the film all kind of say it's a strange, odd, weird film, which, of course, you know, I love. Because who wants just a straight-up boring movie?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us for this edition of Forgotten Horror Classics. Please tune in next time. I'm not 100% sure what I'll be doing, but you can bet it's going to be an interesting and fun movie, and one that I think needs to be revisited. Definitely want to put it out there for folks to be able to see, just like all the other films in this series. So thank you very much. Thank you, Miss Lenore, for joining me.
Oh, no problem.
All right. And we will see you next time on Forgotten Horror Classics.
Bye.
Bye.
Dreams and bones and facts and bones, teenage monsters in haunted homes, a ghost on the stair, a vampire's bite, they're everywhere. There's a full moon tonight. Having a ball, Frankenstein, Dracula, and even the mummy are sure to end up in somebody's tummy. Take a fresh rose, some toadstools and weeds, and add an old owl and the young one she feeds. Mix in seven legs from an eight-legged beast, and then you're all set for a cannibal feast. Sit round a fire with this cup of brew, a fiend and a werewolf on each side of you. This cannibal orgy is strange to behold, and the maddest story ever told.